everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Bootstrapped Web. Mr. Brian Castle, how are you?
Doing good. Doing good. It's Friday. Finishing up, I think, a pretty productive week now. And yeah, ready to head into the weekend.
Memorial Day weekend. I didn't even...
Is it?
Didn't register for a while.
That's usually one of those holidays that just kind of sneaks up on you. It's like, when is that again? Oh, is this weekend? Okay.
You know, things like that don't really sneak up on my wife. She's like real on top of it. But this year was the first time where she's like, oh yeah, we don't have any plans. We're not going anywhere. I'm like, I have barbecue plans. That's basically it. Eating plans.
Yeah, same here. Before we start talking business, like, how have you been dealing like with like socializing, hanging out with friends and things like that? Like, through all this, have you been doing much like Zoom calls with friends and family, stuff like that?
No, we have been doing more FaceTime with family. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like my mom is in New York in an apartment. So, and she's just, that's a long time to just hang out by yourself, basically. Yeah. So we're in really regular contact. My brothers.
Yeah, us too. We've had a lot more calls with the grandparents.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, rightfully, right? That's good. And my dad. And yeah, so we've been doing more family, but, you know, we have that Portland crew of microconfers. I'm, you know, good friends with them now, and we're in a Slack group together. So we talk all the time, and that activity has gone up just in Slack, just talking about more personal and how are you handling things and PPP. And there's just a lot of conversation there. I think everyone's kind of hungry for it.
It's funny. Like, so I'm in a Slack just like that with probably a lot of people that we both know. And I've got to think that like the conversations happening in the Slack that I'm in probably are just a total like mirror of what's happening over there. Like we've had weeks of PPP discussions.
And who got it? Who didn't get it? Who'd you go with? Did you go with Bluevine? Did you go with Bank of America? Should I apply a second time or should I wait?
Totally. Yep. That has definitely increased in activity for us. And we do calls. We have like a private podcast feed that we all post to sometimes. And then we do a lot of Slack. And we've been doing off and on like Friday happy hour. So maybe we'll do that tonight.
Yeah. Yeah. We've done a few of those with the Portland crew, and we've been trying to do them more with the company also. What's happened at the company level is that there's just more room made for personal talk and personal issues. So when we start stand up, right, we have a weekly stand up for just the Portland team. We just don't dive right into work. We laugh a little bit with some funny commentary and, you know, make fun of people's hair. Like we just kind of let that go a little longer because I think that's what everyone wants and needs. And it's helpful as opposed to just, here's the interaction. We're going to talk about work and the interaction's going to end. People want more than that.
Yeah. Yeah, my longtime friends who I grew up with, this COVID thing like has sort of like been an excuse to get back in touch, and so we've been playing poker on Thursday nights on Poker cool. Stars, and we would just fire up a Zoom call alongside it, and so that's been pretty fun to kind of be back in touch. By the way, if anyone plays online poker with Poker Stars, if you want to see an example of an absolutely atrocious piece of software. Poker Stars is like beyond mind-boggling, like just so bad. I'm a software person, and I could not. It's been weeks of I couldn't figure out how to like get into the right room and
this, it's rebuy like a consumer the chips. App. It's supposed to be
it's,
for people.
It's who, ridiculous. It's so bad.
And is that like the leader in the space?
I think so. There's like maybe two or three of them, but that's the one that we've been using. I don't know.
Wow, that sounds wild. You would think there's so much money there that the competition would be good enough to improve the just
totally.
The level.
It's of like acceptance. And it's like a desktop software app that connects. It's crazy. I don't know.
That's funny. I had a frenzy the first few weeks of the crisis, just reaching out to people from high school and just checking up, and you know all the people that you care about but you don't really talk to because your lives don't intersect. There was a big resurgence of that. Like one of my good friends from high school is a police officer in New York. So that was like, whoa, are you okay? Some people are doctors. And, you know, now we're starting to get into this stretch where this might just be a while, like a year.
Settle in, folks.
Yeah, it's pretty strange. Pretty strange. A lot of interesting conversations with the therapist.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
The most frustrating thing about it is that question, how long is this going to last? Because it's like, we don't know. Like, so officially here in Connecticut, things have opened up. I think May 20th was the official reopening date. And people are starting to go out to businesses and things, but a lot are still closed. And so what's the summer going to look like? That's the first question. And then the second question is, what is the fall? Like, is there going to be the big resurgence that everyone's talking about? Like, probably. And then, like, what does 2021 look like? You know, like, because we're going to be nowhere near a vaccine. So,
right.
So it's like,
how much risk are you going to accept?
How much risk is, even if businesses reopen, how much are consumers going to even go out? You know, like I had tickets with my friends to go see Rage Against the Machine in August. That is canceled, you know.
I don't really feel like I have much trouble accepting those things. The travel and not seeing family for an extended time, that bums me out.
It's like, I have no problem accepting it. And especially our lifestyle, we're homebodies anyway.
Yeah.
And I work at home. It's not being able to plan the rest of the year. Like, I don't know if we're going to have like Big Snow Tiny Conf or plan traveling or like, just give me a date when things are going to go back to normal, and nobody can do that. You know?
Yeah, you can't do it. And it's interesting what's happening now in the tech space and the, you know, frenzy of excitement about remote work, and the base camp guys must be, you know, in heaven, all of their dreams are finally coming true, and Facebook doing its Facebook thing. Yeah, we'll go remote, but as soon as we know where you live, we are lowering your goddamn pay.
Yeah, I saw that.
That's Facebook. That was
funny, especially after our episode last week talking about that. Like, Facebook like goes out of their way to be like,
just so you know, you can have the rest of the year, but we will find out where you live.
Because we're Facebook and we really need to tighten our belts around here.
Yes. <you know? laughs> I love it. That impacts everybody. You know, we are excited and confused at the same time. I mean, I should cancel my office, right? I know I should cancel my office, but I just don't want to. But it's $5,000 a month. It's a lot of money. Yeah. So, and it's $5,000 a month in two locations, one in Portland, one in Slovenia. $10,000 a month. That's significant.
You doing anything about that? Like talking to your landlord at all?
In Portland, we have a 30-day out clause. So it is, you know, pull the trigger, boom, move out and done. In Slovenia, we have 6 months. Now, Slovenia is opening up. They did a good job of tightening as soon as, because Bergamo in Italy, that region is right on the border with Slovenia. So they they took it very seriously. So we have some people in the Slovenian side that they want to go to the office a few days a week. They're kind of setting, okay, what if we wear masks? What do we do? How many people per day? They're getting into that. We talk about that in Portland, but we're just nowhere near it. We have a pregnant employee. We have, it's just unrealistic. Can't wrap my mind around accepting sitting in my bedroom where I am right now for the next like 2 years or foreseeable future.
Yeah, it's so crazy.
I fully went down the rabbit hole of one of those prefab like 8-foot by 8-foot office things that they can just drop in your backyard.
Cool. Yeah.
Dude.
Like I don't need one because I have my home office here, but I just want one.
Yes. Yes. I totally agree. And I looked at it, I'm like, the price, it's kind of doable. I know. I mean, compared to, you know, being in this bedroom for 2 years, you have a nice office over there. I can see it. We're on video right now. No one can see it.
Yeah.
That's a nice office.
But it's,
I have a standing
right
desk
next to my
lodged
kids
up against
room,
like,
so.
Well, that's true. Yeah. But you've kind of, you know, you're set up for it. This is not cool. I'm in a stand-up desk that's lodged in front of the fireplace that was once a nice fireplace in my bedroom. No longer.
That's pretty cool. You got a fireplace in there?
I do. This is a really old house and there are fireplaces everywhere because that was the only heat. So we have three fireplaces, but we only use one.
So what's going on in business here?
Okay. What's going on in business? I had an interesting experience. I had my most popular tweet ever last week. Such a lame thing
that's
to
fun.
Say. But it was fun.
And what was it?
I'll read it to you. Here's what I wrote. I can say with 100% certainty that raised an A right now and I was able to take $1 million off the table, that the likelihood of a big outcome becomes much, much more likely. This was in response to the freak out over the news that Clubhouse, yet to be released, raised $10 million from Andreessen Horowitz at a $100 million valuation. So that's a big deal. But the fact that the founders took $2 million off the table, that was like pointed out as like absurdity.
Yeah.
And I very strongly disagree. First of all, you don't know people's particular situation. You don't know if someone put all their life savings in and went into debt for their last company, and this just helps them get out of that. And so they can focus on building the big business. The truth is, we found out a little more in the whole response to it as people freaked out. Someone posted a picture of a tweet that one of the founders turns out has a child with a very severe condition. It's like, why are you jumping to conclusions on that, right? Mm-hmm. To have a kid, a very young child with a serious condition, is mentally, emotionally, and financially devastating.
Yeah.
So what's wrong with them taking some money off the table? And the way I put it was, you know, us raising a Series A is not out of the realm of possibility. I think it's more likely than not, to be honest. And it is scary right now because the business is worth tens of millions of dollars on paper. Right, like yeah. In theory. It's not worth anything until someone pays for it. But if you look at multiples and all that, it's worth tens of millions of dollars. Which means for me personally, if I sold it now, it was definitely life-changing money. So to raise money is a huge risk.
Yeah.
And so taking money off the table when raising is a very reasonable agreement to make with investors. I will risk life-changing money for a lot less if you let me take some money off the table so I'm not in a crunch and I'm not stressed. And that's why I said the likelihood of a big outcome, not a $20 or $30 million look, which is a lot of money, but it's not a big outcome in the tech world. A big outcome of 100 plus becomes much more likely if I'm calm and patient.
I think you made a really good point there. I actually had never thought about it that way, but I think you're totally right. Like, it's the point of, you're taking money off the table, but you're also taking off the table the desire to sell when the first semi-big offer comes along and instead, you know, go super big. And because yes. that's what VC wants. So
right. So it's like if you want me to go for that, I think it's perfectly reasonable to say, well, help me not eat all of that risk, because you're not taking any risk yourself. Even if you have some of your own money in your fund, it's probably because you already have enough money to put into a fund. And more likely than not, it's mostly LP money, which is, you know, a different thing. It's not an individual taking risk the same way. So if you want me to take the risk, help me.
What did you see in like the responses to this? I'm trying to scroll through them. Like, what was sort of like the consensus, or did you get any like pushback, any disagreement?
Only some pushback, but mostly it felt like I had said something that people agreed with but don't normally hear. And so it was a lot of that. It was a lot of people saying, my guess is that people complaining about it don't have kids. That's one way to look at it. Like, people who are saying, hey, you should take money off the table. Yeah, well, have a few kids and a mortgage and tell me how that feels when you're trying to start a business and how different it would feel if you could just shore that up. Like, $1 million is a lot of money, but after taxes, it's not actually that much money. It's just enough that you are calm. Yes. Other people talking about, like, people who against it most likely came from some background of privilege or haven't been close to the metal, let's call it, in their past. Mm-hmm. I thought an interesting point that Austin Reef, one of the founders of Morning Brew, made was that he asked, does the likelihood of going to zero also go up? And that, I think, is the right question, because yes, you have to admit that taking on money makes it more likely to go zero also. Like, if you're swinging for the fences, it's also more likely that it's not going to work out, which is the other side of that.
It's not like you're at this point going to be starting a brand new idea that might be a total failure. You already have some traction, so it's going to grow, and now you have all these extra resources to grow it. So I don't know that it increases the likelihood of zero.
I think it does, though. Overall, yes, you have more fuel in the tank, but you're going to drive a touch more recklessly. Like, that is the point. You are increasing the variance on both sides. More likely to fail, more likely to have a big outcome. right? Whereas bootstrapping, you're trying to keep that variance pretty tight because it's either it's broke, right? Yeah. Or I guess, pretty successful. I guess in a way, pretty successful is so valuable.
I guess by growing super fast and hiring a massive team very quickly and not thinking about profitability, that's where a thing like a global pandemic that you can't expect
can nuke you,
you know, and whereas a bootstrapper might have a little bit more,
I think it's safe
and can weather the storm maybe a little bit more.
People assume that you can cut expenses and they view that in the abstract. And so if let's say we pushed a lot harder and we got to, you know, 10 million in ARR, but not profitable, people look at that and they say, well, you know what? At any point in time, you can just cut expenses and become profitable. What they don't take into account is the ability to just break the company culture and break the confidence and break the team spirit. And it can die out from that alone. So you could be a 10 million ARR and spending 15 million a year and say, okay, we're burning $5 million a year, but we have 20 in the bank. And so that's fine. And if it gets too hairy and too close, then we can just cut expenses and cut staff and get back down to call it 10 million in expenses. And we'll be break even with a few million bucks in the bank. We'll be okay. What you're not realizing is a layoff of call it 30 or 40 or 50% of the company, your best people could just start leaving and just, they don't see a future there. And the promises that you've made and that they have made on their own in their heads is that this thing's going to be a $1 billion company. And that's why I'm here.
Yeah. By the way, what is Clubhouse? I've never heard of it until this news. At first, I thought it was that developer project app, project management app. Like, I was like, what? How big are they?
It's not that. And it's not that. I think you and I are really going to like Clubhouse. What I'm confused by is that people on Twitter are like talking bad about it. Like if you're into Twitter, this is moving toward an audio version. Okay, so here's what it is.
So it's like audio Twitter kind of.
So it's audio Twitter, but if you think about that, think about everyone just shouting, like that's exhausting and it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So there have to be tiers. And this is the part where it gets a little iffy on the execution of it. Right now it's in beta. So it's tiny and it's everyone's hand selected. And there is an enormous reputational risk for acting badly, right? If you're in there with 3,000 people and you know who those people are, a lot of them are very famous VCs and all this other stuff.
So
you are behaving in a certain way.
I have not seen it or downloaded it or had access.
Oh, you can't.
To it. So right, it's closed. So my understanding is, I'm just picturing Twitter, except instead of text, people are just posting audio snippets, and you can just like click and listen to anybody's public audio clip?
No. Think about a podcast. Think about you and I talking right now, and there are 50 people listening, and someone raises their hand electronically and says, I have a comment to make, and we click, and then all of a sudden they're in the conversation with us.
So it's live.
It's live.
Okay. It's a platform for running like live audio events.
That's my understanding of what it's like now, which is, you know, and that's why what's happening is a lot of the people who are in there are super into it, because imagine tonight at 8 o'clock, you knew that some of the, you know what, I think it actually has more serendipity than that. It's people like, let's just say, are on Twitter at night, and then they can form a conversation. So I think the other day it was like Toby, the CEO of Shopify, a famous VC, someone who's like a chef, and then like some, you know, like thinker. And all of a sudden these four people come together and start talking, and you could just listen to those people talk. That's kind of exciting. And then you can ask to participate, and so you could see that it's really hard to do right. Otherwise it turns into a mess.
Yeah.
But it has potential.
I think, and you can take this clip right now and replay it 5 years from now and show how
right I was,
how wrong I was about what I'm going to say, but how right you are, maybe how wrong I am right now. But I just, it's hard for me to see. First of all, there are those things now. You can do live streams with people. You could do like live YouTubes and stuff like that. The other thing about Twitter conversations is that it's passive, or it's quick and efficient. Like to get on an audio call or a video call,
yeah,
synchronous. You got to go into but you got to go get into a quiet space. You can't be around You know, maybe you can't do it in a public place, or you can't do it if your kids are around or something like that. Or like, you know, but with Twitter, you could be sort of on the go and just give a quick reply to something or give a quick like, or, you know, obviously it's not Twitter. It's something else. But
the
serendipity part of it is still like something that I'm like, how does that really play out?
You know? Look, there's a flip side to not being asynchronous, right? Twitter is, you check it when you want. If you don't check it, you missed something. Yeah. It requires a different level of attention, which is more valuable.
The interesting thing that to me is it's the connection to podcasting. Like the one, I don't know, call it a pain point or something when it comes to like doing this podcast, you and me, is that this comes out a week after we've actually had this mm-hmm. conversation. So there's always that delay. Yeah. And then it's always hard to get feedback from people. We do get feedback like on Twitter and stuff, but it's out of context. It's weeks later, you know, if there's some solution for making this more of a conversation, especially for bootstrapper podcasts like ours, you know, and we listen to the other ones too, making that more of a conversation. And then the other thing is private podcasts, which seems to really be getting some traction all around, and all the different podcasting companies are doing it. Yeah. We've hacked together our own private podcast, my buddies in that Slack group.
Right, and so there will be a solution though.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is a very engaging, I think, interesting. It's completely different content. It's not podcast content. It's private.
It doesn't need to replace podcasting. Just like Clubhouse doesn't need to replace Twitter. Just like Clubhouse doesn't need to replace podcasting.
Maybe it does this, but if Clubhouse is asynchronous, right? So it's like, hey, me and Jordan are going to have this conversation. We're in two different time zones. We're going to talk about yay or nay on funding or whatever.
And like, right.
Like I'll post my thing. Then 2 hours later, you post your reply. Then 3 hours later, I post my reply to that. 4 hours later, somebody else chimes in. And then it merges together into this like conversation that anybody can play back.
I could see how that is interesting overall. I think the magic that Clubhouse is going for is if you weren't there, you missed it. I think that's what they're going for. But it hasn't gone public yet. So it'll be interesting to watch. I think about Substack a lot lately.
I keep hearing that. I'm not on that.
It's very, very interesting. It is a...
I feel like an old man today.
It's cranky. What is this new technology thing?
Yeah, like I'm just like out of the loop. Like,
we got MailChimp. I don't need email. Now, Substack is interesting because it reduced the barrier to publishing and at the same time handed over like direct connection with the audience for your own audience. But if you're not on the email list, you didn't necessarily miss out because it's then turned into a web page. Mm-hmm. So then I can write a newsletter to my list, but then tweet it out. And then if you like it, then you easily subscribe to my list. It's like it like removes the need for a blog without the cost of not having things on the web. And then you can charge for it.
It's got a payments piece.
If you want, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Cool. So you can charge, you know, $5 a month for subscribers.
Yeah. I know with MailChimp Forever, you could have a publishable web version of every newsletter. But
yes.
Yeah.
Very so cool. I like all the stuff that's happening.
Yeah.
That's it.
I don't have time anymore to like actually like investigate new tools and stuff, unless it's like something I actually need for my business right now.
But I feel like I always have my radar up for what is this thing? And then that next step of, well, how's it going to be used? Who's going to use it? How do you make money off of it? Why is it valuable that people don't realize yet? Like, you know, I can't help but go there as soon as I see something new.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's do some updates. So right now I'm like knee deep in creating this course. I think I talked about it last week. Well, last week it was more like in an idea phase where the idea is to try to create a legit course, but it's definitely aimed at helping people learn about ProcessKit, get onboarded into ProcessKit, and understand like the best way to set things up for your business, especially if you're in client services. Here are my best advice on how to organize things. And through this course, you know, we're going through how to set up your new client onboarding process, which I've found has definitely been the most common kind of first go-to process that companies are trying to set up in ProcessKit. So last week it was a little bit more theoretical. We were talking about like the Ahrefs course that they've done and how that's like a pretty good model for what I'm going for here, which is definitely the case. So this past week was get to work, just get this thing rolling. And so I feel like now the most grueling part of it is finally just done now. So I spent the whole week writing. Like I created like a written version of this course, which is a lot of text, but it's mostly images, really. It's mostly like screenshots, like tutorial-based lessons. I wrote that. I've just been in Google Docs writing these lessons for the past week. It turned out to be like 12 lessons. Really, it's 9 lessons, but there's 3 of them that are just Zapier tutorials. And so I wrote those out, got screenshots on them. That was like the hardest, like creative part of it. And now I'm going back and basically creating video versions, like kind of reading off of the script that I already wrote, but doing a lot of editing and flipping between me sitting on camera to on the screen, you know, using ProcessKit. So I just began that video piece today. So hopefully like over the next week, I'll be doing the video piece. I put up an ad on Upwork to get somebody to just convert these Google Docs into nice clean HTML, because at some point I'm going to create like a whole section of the website to present this course. And it, since it turned out to be like 12 different pretty long Google Docs and like over 100 different images and stuff, like that'll just be a slog to get the HTML, you know, knocked out for that. So I'm just going to have somebody to do that.
You wouldn't use some like off the shelf course software?
No.
You want to put it into the site the way you want?
Yeah, because it's going to live on processkit.com. It's not going to be like course.processkit.com. It's going to be on the main domain, and that is a static site, and it'll be integrated into the design. But just the content of the course, it's going to need to be put from Google Docs into P tags and list tags and H1 tags and image tags. And at first, I was just going to do that, but turned out to be a lot of pages. So now I'm definitely not going to be doing that. And then the video stuff. And then at some point, I probably won't get to this until 2 weeks from now or so, but I'm going to need to integrate it into ProcessKit's onboarding somehow.
I was going to ask, what are you going to do with it? Are you going to like amp it up like a new release? Are you going to
Well, I'm definitely amping it up like, I'm gonna definitely try to get as much exposure for the course, like marketing wise. Like maybe I'll release it on Product Hunt, and maybe I'll really promote it. But ultimately, it's gonna be an asset that is aimed at onboarding customers. So I'll put it into the email sequence for new users. I want to figure out exactly what I want to do in the app. Like, should I have just one pop up at the beginning? Should I have like a step by step like onboarding guide kind of thing, like
right, or link to it based on the page that they're on, link to the lesson.
It's like how fancy do I want to get with it? Mm-hmm. But
is it going to live on the other side of the paywall, like publicly people will be able to access it? Or
it's going to be free and public.
Cool.
It'll live on the marketing site, but I will either link over to it from the app or take the videos from it and embed those in the app so that it sort of lives in both places.
Yeah. You could also link the individual lessons from onboarding emails. The truth is you could mimic the structure of the course closely with the onboarding emails.
Well, yeah. And that's how I created the course and the lesson list was like, these are the things that you should probably get a handle on if you're going to turn into a paying customer. And it doesn't cover everything. I tried to focus it only on like do enough to get the minimum level of value from ProcessKit while seeing the power that you could ultimately get if you really dig in, but do enough and you get to the point where people have converted to paid. You know, there's a lot you can do with ProcessKit, but most people convert to paid once they've set up like maybe 20 or 25% of their operation in ProcessKit. You know, like once you get to that point, it's like go from like 0 to 10 or 20% set up. Now you'll feel confident with it.
Yeah. And then you have a long way to go.
Yeah.
Nice, man. I'm very interested. We've talked about it. But it is built around this. We've never done it.
Well, it and it does follow along a single example throughout the whole course, like of setting up your new client onboarding process, right? And so by the end of this course, like you'll have a pretty good handle on that important process, and that should be enough to be like, okay, I'm seeing value from this now. You know, we want to continue using Process Kit, hopefully.
Nice, man. Let's see. We're a little short on time. I have about a few minutes before a call. The big thing for us right now is hiring. There's definitely an element to profitable confidence. You know, I like that saying. You know, I fell out of that for a while when we weren't profitable, and now that we're back to profitable, it's a big deal, like psychologically. What it does, at least for me, is it just makes me more willing to take on risk. And hiring is one of the biggest risks. Full-time W-2 employee, health insurance, benefits, all that. It's just a very big risk. The last thing you want to do is hire someone. Going back to what we said again, it's not so easy to just change expenses. Hiring someone full-time and then just being like, you know what? I've decided not to spend the 10 or 12 grand a month. So I'm just going to fire this person after 3 months. It's kind of,
you can't just like firing someone. It's not like canceling a SaaS.
Exactly.
This person probably left another job to come work at Cardhook.
So exactly right. And everyone's watching, you know, not in like a nefarious way, but people watch how you treat people. And then they put themselves in those shoes. It's why we've always emphasized, like when someone leaves, when someone resigns, or if someone's terminated, like people are watching how that happens and how you behave in that situation, because they will put themselves in that person's shoes. When I resign and I decide, okay, I'm kind of done with this version, this part of my career, how am I going to be treated and thought of and talked about after I leave? It's like all those things matter. Mm-hmm. So we went from hiring two people, a support specialist and a support engineer, to now hiring four people. The support positions and now two back-end Laravel engineers at a senior level. But I think that's what we need right now.
And all four of them are remote, different places?
Yes. Yes. So we're going to go from 18 people into offices to 22 people, with those four being fully remote. And
very cool.
Yeah, so that's really exciting. And I think I talked about this last time, but it's worth reiterating. We were concerned about our ability to attract talent on the development side. Slovenia is not very big. There aren't that many people in the Laravel community there.
Yeah, and you go worldwide, it's like...
Right, that's what we're hoping for. The other factor in Slovenia is that some of the big European companies have figured out over the past 10 years that there's good talent there that isn't as expensive as, let's say, London or Paris or even Berlin. And so a lot of good Slovenian engineers make an amazing living working for these international companies. Mm-hmm. And once they get on that, unless they're super gung-ho for startups and wanting to like kind of have a bigger impact, it's tough to compete with a $200,000 salary anywhere.
Yeah.
So now we put job ads up, and I kind of reached out to people in the Laravel community to kind of help me out and retweet and that sort of thing. And the response is phenomenal. I think we have 150 or so
That's great.
Applicants. And that, I think that really pumped up Rock, you know, as the CTO, where he was concerned about how do we attract talent. Now it's like, oh my God, if we look at the top 10%, we have way too many, we still have to cut, you know, 13 people.
Yeah.
So that really has us pumped up. And
yeah, and then you also build up that database that you can go back to.
Yes.
Talent.
And we love Laravel, and we don't want to leave it. So it's just really encouraging to be able to go worldwide and then get that level of response.
Awesome.
Yeah, so that's exciting. So hopefully, you know, the development hiring process, it's tough.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of the applicant. It's like you apply, you hear a little bit, and here's like a 4-hour task that we are judging everything on this task. It's pretty hardcore. I've been trying to take a step back and not just assume whatever process we have is right. I mean, it's almost certainly not exactly right. So I've thought more and more about how it feels to be an applicant for all the roles. How quickly do we respond to them? What are we saying? What are we talking about? Right? Do we talk about them? Do we talk about the company? Do we talk about what we need? Do we talk about who we're looking for? Like, all these things matter. There's an amazing job ad put up by YNAB, and that really helped inspire us. You know, they're really selling more than the salary and the employment.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you need to do.
I feel like for engineers, you have to.
Yeah. You need true believers. Yeah. You know, they can.
And I feel like probably more than any other role, the engineers need to know what are they going to be working with in terms of tech stacks, in terms of what their team is going to be, what the development process is like, right? Like, this stuff really matters, you know, because it's literally like, am I engaged in my work or do I want to, you know, it's terrible every day.
Yes. Like, am I rewriting something for the third time and I'm going to be working on that for a year, or am I going to be pushing things forward? Very big difference.
Yeah. Yep. So been talking about the onboarding stuff, but I've been also doing just as much work on the sales demos that I'm doing with ProcessKit. Okay. I still do a handful of those every week. I talked earlier about how I felt like the demos have been haphazard, and like, I just kind of feel them out and we talk about whatever and I show them ProcessKit, and then it's like, okay, good luck. You know, let me know if you have any questions. I've got a lot of good feedback and advice from my friends in that group and everything, and from you and from other folks. And so I feel like I have gotten better at doing the sales demos for ProcessKit, and I feel like I'm, and still just the beginning of this. I know it's going to get much better over time. I do feel like I have a very clear step-by-step how I'm guiding these calls. And so basically, the first part of the call, so it's basically like three parts, right? The first part is not super different from what I've been doing historically. It's kind of like get to know you. It's very similar to audience ops in that I like to talk to most of these people about, because it's just fun conversations, like talk and shop, business owner to business owner usually.
Yeah. What do you do?
Tell me about your business. But then I always get right to like, what are the tools that you're currently using? And maybe I already know that from a form that they filled out, but what are you using? And then I'm really digging into, tell me exactly what it is that broke down for you in that tool, or where's the pain point and why are you even talking to me? Because I'm not forcing demo calls right now. I talked about maybe doing that, but I'm not. Yeah. You could just come to the site and sign up for a trial and not talk to me.
So this is someone who wants to talk.
But people do want to talk. Like, there's still 3 to 5 of these a week of people who've reached out. So something has taken them to a slightly extra level of like, okay, I'm going to sit down. And some of the calls, and sometimes these are surprises to me, one person books the call, I get on the call and they've invited 6 coworkers onto this call. And all of a sudden I'm doing like a presentation, like, oh shit.
It's a good sign.
So I'm really understanding the pain. And then I go into the, call it a demo, but really I'm only going to show the 1 or 2 features in ProcessKit that relate to the pain that they talked about, you know? Like, oh, our team, like, they're not following everyone's kind of like doing their own thing. They're not really following a process. Okay, I'll show you how we copy a process into task lists every time, you know? Or like, oh, we've got our stuff, like, it's hard to do video or whatever. Like, okay, let me show you how you can embed a video. Like, and now I'm always going to my pre-made demo account. I'm not like helping them. I used to be like helping them set up their own ProcessKit trial account. That takes too long to like do with them on a sales call. I need to show them like straight to the magic. Like, look, I'm just going to click this button and I just fired up an onboarding project that just pulled in all these tasks and these automations. Like that's pretty cool. Like, you know, I'm not going to show them how I set all that up. I'm just going to show them like, this is the final result. Yes. This is what happened, you know?
Yeah. How to do it. That's next.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the last piece, the third part of the call is next steps. And inevitably they're going to want to play around with it themselves. There's no getting around that. I can't, like, in this product, this market, I'm not going to get them to buy on the spot before they start using it or getting their team to adopt it. So what I've been doing is, okay, so you can proceed with your free trial. You have a 2-week trial. Definitely, you know, let me know if you have any questions. But what I recommend is that we always schedule a call a week from now, So like 1 week into your trial, let's get that on the books. And then I'll do a check-in call with you and see how things are going. And so I started pitching that about a week ago. And now three demos have, the three times that I've pitched it, they've all agreed to it and they booked the follow-up call.
Okay. You know?
So, and I think that's a good sign because it's not like, you know, it shows that they are committed. And sometimes they've even said this to me. They're like, okay, that's really good because it'll really force me to actually try it out and I won't get busy. So I know that we'll have this call at Tuesday at 3 o'clock to check in. I think next week I have those check-in calls for the first time. And so that'll be like, okay, they'll have more specific questions about how to set things up. That's where I'm going to really dig into what are your objections to converting at this point. Or if they really need help, that's where I could pitch the implementation service. And I mentioned that on the first call, but they're like, okay, let me try it out first and maybe I'll come back to that. I'm paying you for it, you know.
I like that. I think you're going to learn a lot on that second call. My guess is you'll be able to spot out someone who's going to convert immediately on that second call.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I think so. That's the goal. I definitely feel more confident with these demos. Like I know how to handle them now, you know, and now it's just a matter of like getting better at them, making them even more consistent.
Yeah. Nice, man. And yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing, I already saw some progress from you on the course on Twitter. So looking forward to seeing that come together.
Yeah. Trying to bang that out.
Cool, man. Well, I got a boogie. I got a jammed Friday.
There you go.
I don't know why I did that to myself, but that's how it goes.
All right.
Good catching up. Thanks for listening.